I'll watch it someday. Actually, yesterday I was also in here. I was gone and I was at the collection committee on social services. Put it in the social.
I can't do
it. I saw him, but I obviously couldn't come in the middle of the meeting to tell him. So I'll go to the second hour.
So why do you want to leave the
table? Because I'm watching whoever puts in their pocket, I will see. Because at the back, you see sometimes I don't put in my phone.
Okay, that would be the most ideal place to put it, ne?
Where, brother?
To get all the
things. Yeah, especially the chairperson coming.
Yeah, she'll be sitting in front. I think that there won't be that much of a number. Around about five or six, yeah. So this would be, yeah.
Oh, you went to the other venue. I thought it might have time. So, what is good in the other venue? Are they performing in the
room? We recommend amendment. When you start to along the way,
I know the banks want to also push an agenda. Banks. But they had an opportunity.
I know.
And we had an eye about what interest rates they use. 30%, 40%, 40%. They are only allowed to give about 25%. Not more than that. It's affecting the pocket. Yeah, but you can't be greedy because you know what? Poor people are going for those loans because it's easier to get it. And they're getting trapped in this thing.
And you can't be greedy.
Yes. And Indian members pushed for that rate to be even lower. They didn't want that 20. It was 25%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they didn't want it
25%.
Not a credit card, a debit card. So I said, no, you're not allowed. You know the app, you're not allowed to call, make calls. He says, no, I know the app, but this is not a credit card, it's a debit card. I said, what's the difference? The fact of the matter is, when I use that card, I'll be owing. You know? I said, you're not allowed to do this. And you're phoning trade in industry. It's crazy, officials. And they're now changing the titles of the cards. Soon they'll say the winning card. As long as it's not defined as a debit or credit card. You see, it's a big
deal.
They're going to redefine. Redefining the card. Cash card. Yeah, that's okay, isn't it?
How is that going to be a very small percentage of
the economy? They were talking about regulating the prostitution industry.
I
know. Why are you going to get that bus? They're going to start calling the cook.
You know what the minister says?
I will not be part of that bus. You're on your own.
Everything,
you know, the next time I want to try to get to ask them, but they were discussing it. They discussed it 3 years ago because that is a multi-billion industry which is not paying any taxes. I mean, that's the film industry. Hi, Vivi.
How's everybody?
How are you?
Fine.
So, I mean, don't be surprised. I will not stay to be parliamentary officer on that boat. My DC will have to hire a parliamentary officer specifically for that boat. I will push my Christian values very high.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I want
to create that. A lot of responsibility that night. You know that debate was on the card in 2003, 2004. That an alliteration was easy. He would have see, but they are enforcement. You are regulated. They were asking, I saw Tina in Boca yesterday. You know Tina in Boca? From Canada. They were saying that one is necessary to try and have the fact that usually acted under them. I said, no, usually acted always under us. We regulate it. I mean, policy dictates who deals with the law and who deals with the law. And once policy has been developed, cabinet approves to see, you know, okay, fine, they take the recommendation by the department. So, because they still want credit and debt. That's not very serious. But I think now the competition is being think I'm happy with the decision from the American Food. Over the whole, didn't cost you and stuff like that. So now then, from the first time, she comes to Parliament. She tells Parliament exactly now they're running the, how the structure of the bank looks like, what is the surplus, how they can engage government in this idea. So, but I think they have a reason in doing that. They must have for the social development of the country. But now they think they want to come and approach Congress, find out how they can create a system. So I mean, they can assist us. We are struggling with access to finance. We say for everything to manage the money. And the interest equals to the fees. There's a big difference though. The interest is lower than the fees that you pay. If you calculate that. Because you're getting 10-5% interest a month. And if you look at how many withdrawals you make and how many deposits you make. So they are gaining more out of you than you are. There's no balance.
Yeah.
You see?
And that's
because they should say you should get 2% of the interest that this person is giving, or 1% as a fee. So if you give me 6% on whatever amount you've got in your account, you can only get 2% of it. That should be a regulated thing, and not higher than the interest. You see? Because more people, if you have more money, that means you benefit. But if you have less money, then you don't benefit. Because then you pay more fees than you
should.
Exactly. And that is including the interest that they're giving you. They're taking that money back. Just there from coffee. Can't get coffee?
Thank you.
I'm fixed on at the NCOP selection committee, making a position of the conference. If you get this message, just give me a call, because I'm made help by the office after.
Thank you.
Tell me when are you free, so that we can discuss the program going forward. Thank you. Bye.
And I don't know why.
And it's always true, you know, when?
Yeah, I wonder why, because
I thought she was going to be on a
Friday. I thought she was running a
Friday. Well, our argument was that during commercial should be on Friday.
Oh,
okay. We have one?
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the hospital.
I don't know about me. I don't know about me.
But maybe if we could try and debrief those few that are left, then can engage. But then, when we come back in August, then we will engage with the department fully. And if there are any amendments that we make, then we can do that at that particular time. So I will now hand over to the department. But before I do that, I will just tell the department who we are. I'm not so concerned, and I chair the committee. I also represent the Western Cape in the MCOT.
Good evening, I am Corona, coming from the Central. Jibu Lindsay, Western Cape. Substance government, there was nothing like that. It's all the colony from Norfolk.
Chair, we've got our legal advisor.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My apologies. I'm not part of the presentation team this morning, but I am based here in the parliamentary office and I've been requested to be here and listen. Basically, I would later down the line gladly participate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Anne. That's why I saw you in town the other day. Well, I think I saw you twice in town. So anyway, let's give over to you, except for that member of you before they leave the IAP. Okay. No, you can use any of them.
Good morning, honorable members and ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to come and brief you on the company's bill. And I always, when I make a presentation on the company's bill, given the time constraints that I'm given today, you know, just warn the members that unfortunately that is such a presentation that it usually takes the whole day, in some cases even 2 days. But today I will try to go as quickly as possible to finish it, given the fact that even, you know, you as a committee have to meet to be in another committee. I will try to do it in about 45 minutes to an hour. I cannot promise that I will be finished in 45 minutes, but at least in an hour I will be. purpose really of this presentation is to just present a high-level overview of the company's bill and to inform the members about the proposed revised timetable for reform. I know that this is old history. Many of you are aware that the corporate law reform process was actually started within the department in 2002, and in 2004 we published the reform policy paper and updated it in 2005. And then according to that policy paper, the following observations were made, that there was no unsubstantial review of company law in over 30 years, except for the introduction of the Close Corporations Act in 1984, that in contrast with that situation, international jurisdictions, most of which have been followed in terms of this law reform, do undergo substantial revisions of their corporate law on an ongoing basis, and that to a large extent, global and domestic environment has sent significant business disturbances. That is the time when the Companies Act was introduced. I mean, the Companies Act is the product of the Van Wyk Decree Commission recommendation, and the committee was appointed in 1963, and it recommended, and the report was published in 1972, and it then became law at the end of 1972, but only to become effective in 1973. And ever since then, there has never been any substantial reform of company law. To a large extent, there have been technical amendments to the Act, which have actually made the Act to be quite complicated and out of line with modern and international trends. And another thing is that corporate structure and financial instruments have changed significantly since then. And because of the advent of electronic communication, social awareness and changing markets, there's an urgent need for the reform of company law at this moment. Other factors that come into place include globalizing markets, standards and expectations. On the issue of standards, we are aware that to a large extent, many developing and developed countries are now in tune with corporate governance standards that have been proposed in a large number of cases by the committees on corporate governance in many jurisdictions in South Africa, the King Committee. And insofar as standards are concerned, we are aware that there has been a globalizing move as early as the 1970s when the Accounting Practices Board in South Africa was established, and then it took over the standard financial reporting standards as recommended by the International Accounting Standards Board. And as a result, standards all over the world have been globalized, but South Africa has only been limited in a number of cases to listed companies, and some companies and other companies have not been subjected to international standards. And another major factor was that in the late 90s and in the early 2000s, we have seen a number of corporate failures and scandals in South Africa and elsewhere, particularly in developed countries, and which highlighted corporate governance issues. And in South Africa in particular, we have seen socio-political and economic change after the 1994 democratic election. And that the law needs to be put in line with related legislation, including the Securities Services Act, which was made effective in 2005, the Auditing Professions Act, which was made effective last year in 2006, and the Black Economic Empowerment Strategy and Act, which culminated in the COVID early this year, and the PFMA of 1999, and then the second King Committee of 2002, and currently there are measures to come up with a third King Committee on corporate governance, and also the recommendations of the Mayor Commission and the Maybe Commission. The 1973 Act, following what I have read, the 1973 Companies Act, you know, is highly outdated formalistic and has unnecessarily burdened some information requirements, is creditor oriented and is overly criminal. As a result, there is an urgent need for reform. Now, in terms of the policy document which was published in 2004, five main objectives were identified as being important for the reform of company law. And this obviously has got sub items and specific roles, but I will only speak to the five main objectives. The first one being the simplification of the procedures for forming companies and reduction of costs associated with the formalities of forming a company and maintaining its existence. And this was in line with the broader government objective to try to bridge the gap between the first and second economy and to make incorporation a matter of a right rather than a privilege that it is currently. And the promotion of innovation and investment in South African markets and companies by providing for firstly flexibility in the design and organization of companies. That is in order to try to accommodate the standards, the expectations, and globalizing trends that I've already explained. And secondly, to provide for a more predictable and effective regulatory environment for the effective enforcement of the law. And thirdly, to promote the efficiency of companies and their management, to encourage transparency and high standards of corporate governance, particularly for your large public interest companies. And finally, to make the law compatible and harmonious with best practice jurisdictions internationally. As I've already explained, that many jurisdictions from which South Africa has adopted company law traditions have been undergoing revisions of company law on an ongoing basis. And therefore, we are far behind, and that is why there's a need to make our law compatible and harmonious with best practice jurisdictions internationally. Now, we thought it would be best to just put this in context. When we started the reform in 2003, the corporate structure or the business structure in South Africa was more or less as it is depicted here, and it is still as it is depicted here at the moment in terms of percentages. By the end of July 2006, this was the number of entities that were available in the South African economy. And you can see from this that over 98%, exact to be exact, 99% of all registered entities are basically privately owned. They may not all be owned and managed, but all of them are privately owned in the sense that they constitute closed corporations and private companies. And in the private companies category, over 70% of those are owner managed. And all those corporations are owner managed. And therefore you can see that the majority of our businesses that are registered are actually owner managed companies or corporations. And as a result, you will realize the importance now of simplification of procedures for forming and maintaining the existence of a company in South Africa for the overall purpose of bridging the gap between the first and the second economy. And also when you look at the informal economy, that is constituted over 23.8% of all businesses in the economy, and the sole proprietors and partnerships which are not registered in terms of any law but are operating in the economy constitute over 22.2%. You realize the main thrust of the reform of trying to formalize the economy and making it easy for corporatization to take place in South Africa. That it is quite important given the fact that we do have a number of entities which are not in the statistics rather system. particularly the those who are in the formal economy and those that are operating as sole proprietorships and as partnerships. And therefore, the total number of the enterprises in the economy is just over 7 million.
We have the same owned enterprise, the same installation.
Yeah, the state-owned enterprises have not been separately placed because most of them are basically private companies. They are constituted as private companies. They are within the state. They are included within the state. Most of them, when they corporatize, they corporatize as private companies. I don't know whether maybe the members would like me as one of their main or their first concern is to try to give you at a later stage the breakdown of the private companies into owner managed and other companies including state owned enterprises.
Okay.
No,
not now. But
when we get to meet. Thank you very much. Having said that, we then went into drafting the new legislation, and the drafting was followed by the recommendations in the guidelines for drafting of corporate law reform, which started then in August 2005. And then we ended in July 2006 with a draft bill that had about 9 chapters and 6 schedules, mainly granting to about 376 states. And that particular bill addresses issues from the time of incorporation to the time of winding up and the time of business rescue. And it also addresses issues like how the companies are financed, how the companies are governed, and how to take over offers and fundamental conditions take place within companies, and how provisions of the Companies Act enforced. And it also covers issues relating to regulatory agencies that are responsible for the administration of the Act and the enforcement thereof. And it also deals with offenses and other matters. And to a large extent, this was a major achievement. Because in many jurisdictions which had undertaken corporate law reform in the recent years, we have seen that the mammoth task has always been to try to put the legislation simple and short. In Australia, they've got legislation that runs into over 5,000 sections, which is quite mammoth a task, because they have gone the way of legislation almost everything that is incidentally linked to company law. In the UK, we have seen the Parliament of the UK legislating on the Companies Act in the end of 2006, and their legislation was actually the largest by volume ever passed by the Parliament of the UK ever since its inception. And you can imagine the challenge that rests upon people who are responsible for drafting such legislation. So far as South Africa is concerned, we aim at legislation for core company law, rather than legislation for anything and everything that is incidentally linked to company law. We followed the model mainly insofar as identification of core company law is concerned, the model of the New Zealand, which made it clear from the beginning that they were going to legislate core company law issues rather than everything that is linked to company law. Now, to a large extent, Chapter 1 is very much an issue of a very dry it is made up of a very dry dry areas of definition of checkers and application. But in order to just bring it alive to the members, now you would realize that in contrast to the 1973 Act, which had about 43 definitions, this particular bill has 100 definitions, which many of which reflect the new substantive provisions which have been included in the new bill. And these substantive provisions actually cover areas such as amalgamation, which has not been there under the 1973 Act, the definition of a closely held company, the distribution, which is now being defined to include or to subject all distributions to the same kind of treatment as opposed to the 1973 Companies Act, which had distributions in three different sections and treated them differently. And we have got the definition of measure, which is a new concept that is introduced in terms of the Companies Act. As you may be aware, that combinations of companies in the Companies Act was undertaken through the Section 311 scheme of arrangement, and there was never a self-standing measure provision as it exists in other jurisdictions. And therefore, the companies will introduce concepts such as measure. I will come back to the content of the measure provision when I deal with Chapter 5, but currently just to highlight what main substantive definitions are there. And the definition of a not-for-profit company and a public interest company. These many new definitions actually reflect the new substantive provisions that require new definitions to be introduced. Now, in Part B, what is of utmost importance is that you realize that there are actually two main sections that are of particular relevance. The first one relates to the purposes of the Act, which basically takes into account the objectives of company law as reflected in the company law reform policy. And secondly, you have got Section 8, which basically discusses the categories of your business corporations. Those are your for-profit companies. And this section basically defines that profit companies as those that are either widely held or closely held. Now, for the sake of a better term, I would equate widely held companies with your current day public companies, and your closely held companies has been a combination of your private company and your close corporation. Since it does not only take into account the characteristics of a private company, but those of a close corporation in terms of a close corporation. Now, in brief, this is the structure of the categories of companies as proposed. And you will realize that in the main, you've got two categories of companies. Those are for-profit companies, which are your business corporations, and your not-for-profit companies, which are your non-profit companies, as some people call them, and they are basically a successor to your Section 21 companies as currently provided for under the Companies Act. And to a large extent, what the law has been, what the shift is here is that instead of presuming all non-profit companies to be public companies, the legislation specifically identifies them as a separate subset or category of companies which have to comply with certain established fundamental rules that are set out in Section 12. And it also excludes them from exempts them from certain provisions of the Companies Act as it is done currently under Section 11 of the bill. And insofar as your business corporations are concerned, these are your for-profit companies, as I've already said, your widely held and closely held companies. Now, just to add some meat to this slide, your widely held companies are those companies that, in terms of their memorandum of incorporation, which will be the only governing document of the company, are allowed to offer their shares to the public in the first place. And secondly, they provide for unrestricted transferability of their shares or their securities, meaning that the liquidity of their security is quite highly the liquidity of their securities is made quite very high, in the sense that there are no restrictions on the transferability of their securities. You're currently a public company. Therefore, this kind of companies may either be listed or not listed. Those that will be listed, obviously, in addition to complying with the Companies Act, they would need to comply with the listing requirements of the listing authority, currently the JSE. Your closely held company are the opposite of your widely held company. And to a large extent, if I were to define them, I would say that they are those companies that do not offer their securities to the public, securities including shares, to the public. And secondly, that they restrict the transferability of their shares in the sense that the liquidity of their investment or the liquidity of their securities is quite limited, in the sense that there are provisions in the memorandum of incorporation relating to how their securities can be transferred between different investors. Therefore, you can see the characteristics of a private company there and also the characteristics of your closed corporation. The number of shareholders does no longer play a crucial role. As you may be aware, that the limit of the number of shareholders for private companies was 50, excluding employees or former employees. And insofar as closed corporations are concerned, your limit was, or your maximum number of shareholders of members is, in terms of the closed corporations, at 10, a natural person. And also, the closely held company does not take into account the nature of a shareholder or the nature of the security holder within that company, as does the closed corporations act. Now, the public interest company, which is provided for in terms of Section 9 of the bill, is an overriding category of company. It's not a separate category of a company. It's an overriding category of company because it may include any of the companies under the two categories above may become a public interest company. Now, let's just see how companies become public interest companies. And the reason for the introduction of this category of company was so that those provisions that provide for stringent corporate governance and financial reporting standards will then be applied, particularly to these types of companies, rather than be applied across the board to all companies. And the public interest companies are made up of firstly your widely held companies. Basically, your present day public companies will become public interest companies. And in addition to that, a closely held company will only become a public interest company if it meets two of the three identified thresholds. And those are determined in terms of size. And currently what the bill proposes is that if a company meets any of the following three, two of the three categories, thresholds, it will become a public interest company. And they are, for your for-profit company, they are 50 million in terms of your annual turnover, 25 million in terms of your net asset value, and 200 in terms of your average number of employees. And for your not-for-profit company, non-profit company, it is 20 million in respect of your annual turnover, 10 million in respect of your net asset value, and 50 in respect to your average number of employees within that company. If any two of those three thresholds are met by any of the two categories of companies, then it becomes a public interest company, which means then that it has to comply with a more stringent corporate governance and financial reporting regime that is provided for in the bill. Now, what are those consequences for characterization as a public interest company? I have only identified a few most important ones. I haven't taken all of them on board, but they will understand the reason why the bill identifies certain companies as public interest companies. In terms of Section 15, all public interest companies must file their memoranda of incorporation with the commission. And closely held companies that do not qualify as public interest companies are not required to file their memorandum of incorporation with the commission, but they are required to keep their memorandum of incorporation at their registered place of business. And in terms of Section 79, all public interest companies are specifically required to hold an annual general meeting, while your closely held companies will hold meetings as and when determined by the memorandum of incorporation. The public interest company must make sure that their meetings are accessible within the Republic for electronic participation by all the shareholders or members, and that a public interest company has a higher number, a higher minimum number of directors in terms of Section 84, and that is currently 4 directors. And the public interest company is required in terms of statutes to keep the directors registered in terms of Section 94. And Section 96 and 97 actually contemplate more stringent financial reporting standards to be prescribed for public interest companies. Just to give a background to that. Currently, even though I've spoken about the international financial reporting standards, which have currently been enforced for listed companies in South Africa, the process has always been in the private domain, meaning that it has been the process that has been undertaken by the private sector rather than legislated through a government-regulated body. What has happened is that in the early 70s, when the International Financial Reporting Standards Body was formed, there was an attempt in many jurisdictions, Commonwealth jurisdictions, to ensure that there is a recognition of those standards. In South Africa, this has not been done by way of legislation, but it was done by an initiative of the JSE and the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. And they together formed a body called the Accounting Practices Board. And the Accounting Practices Board was responsible for implementing those standards that they thought would be of importance in South Africa. And they were applicable basically to your listed companies as generally accepted accounting practice principles. Now, in order to enforce compliance with those standards, what has happened is that the private sector formed a gap monitoring panel, which was under the auspices of the JSE. The gap monitoring panel and the APB were basically replaced by the government regulator, or statutory regulated bodies, which will be in the form of the Financial Reporting Standards Council, which will be the equivalent of current APB, but which will then have a broader mandate rather than the mandate to only apply them from standards in respect of listed companies. And the Gap Monitoring Panel will be replaced by your Financial Reporting Standards Panel, which will then have the mandate, broader mandate than that, which applies in respect of Gap Monitoring Panel. Now, the principle from the bill is that all companies are required to keep accurate accounting records to fairly represent the state of affairs of the business of the company and to explain all transactions and the financial position of the company. Now, as I've already pointed out, the minister, after consulting with the Financial Reporting Standards Council, which is provided for under Chapter 8, will make regulations prescribing financial records and report standards. And these regulations may establish different standards applicable to public interest as opposed to non-public interest companies. Now, on this point, let me just mention that attempts internationally have always been that insofar as your closely held companies are concerned, financial reporting standards should not be the same as those that are applicable to your public interest companies, the likes of your listed companies. And therefore, there have been attempts even by the international accounting standards body to come up with different standards for your social health companies for small and medium-sized enterprises. These are currently being reviewed by the international accounting standards body and will most likely be made applicable throughout the member jurisdictions in early 2009. And therefore, such standards are different from the standards that are applicable to your public interest companies. These are your public companies, which are currently enforced through the APB and the government monitoring panel. Now, what is important is that even though the regulations may prescribe different financial reporting standards, they must actually be in line with international reporting, international financial reporting standards, as already explained. Now, as I've already pointed out, the requirement for a financial statement is not dependent on whether the company is public interest or not, but it is the requirement to file the annual financial statement that is dependent on whether you're a public interest company. Those companies that are not public interest companies will not be required to file the annual financial statement with the commission, but they are required to keep those statements at their registered office so that they could be accessible by their shareholders, and therefore they may even put them on their website if they do have websites, so that they could be accessible by their shareholders and members of the public generally, but they are not then required to have them lodged with the commission. Now, importantly, Section 100 only requires public interest companies to have public audit committees and to appoint auditors, and they subject those companies to stricter audit practices than our non-public interest companies, in the sense that the members of the audit committee have to be independent or ex-independently, and that they will not be able to engage into other activities that will then compromise their independence as members of the audit committee, and that the auditors must rotate on a regular basis. I think at the moment the bill is 5 years of rotation, so that there could be an independent judgment to pay upon those members who are providing their services to public interest companies. But that is not the case for your social health company. What is important is that not all social health companies that are public interest companies will be required to have audit committees. Certain social health companies that are public interest companies will not be required to have audit committees, particularly those that are subsidiaries of a holding company and the audit committee of a holding company performs the same functions of the audit committee in the subsidiary company. Then the subsidiary company will not be required to have an audit committee, even though it may be a public interest company by definition. In addition to that, the minister, by means of government gazette, exempts certain companies that are public interest companies from complying with the requirements to appoint audit committee. But still, where the minister is of the view that it will serve no purpose for such companies to constitute public audit committees. Now, Chapter 2 deals with formation and registration of companies. And to a large extent, what this chapter attempts to do is to give effect to the objective of simplifying company registration procedures and reducing the cost associated with the process of forming a company and maintaining its existence, as reflected in the policy document. Section 13, for example, requires a minimum of one person to form any type of a for-profit company, this is a business corporation. And it requires at least three persons to form a not-for-profit company, as opposed to your current Section 19 and Section 21 provisions of the 1973 Act, which requires a minimum of seven members to form your not-for-profit company, which basically has been members have been just added for the sake of compliance and therefore there has been formal compliance rather than substantive compliance, because the requirement of 7 members actually serves no purpose except to encourage sham compliance. And to a large extent, the current act actually, by it deeming not-for-profit companies to be public companies, that actually meant that a number of provisions that are specifically suited for public companies are then applied to your non-profit companies, which may not be necessary. Now, the question has been asked to us as to why are we requiring 1 person for your business corporation and then 3 persons for your not-for-profit company. The reason is simple. Many of your not-for-profit companies usually register, not usually, almost invariably register with the tax exemption unit of the South African Revenue Service for tax exemption purposes. And the requirement of the Income Tax Act, currently I think it's Section 18, requires that such companies need to be identified as public interest organizations, and they have to perform certain functions. Now, almost all companies that will be registered in terms of the Companies Act will need to apply for public interest benefit as public benefit organization status, which means that they would need to be exempted from paying tax for tax purposes. And that the legislation requires that it must be, that organization must be led by 3 unrelated persons who are going to take fiduciary responsibility of that particular organization. As a result, if we were to create a company that could be formed by only 1 person as a not-for-profit company, we would be creating an illusion that that company may have the consequences desired when it is formed, which is to qualify as a public benefit organization. And as a result, it would be quite in conflict with what many purposes of this not-for-profit companies are. Now, the bill also facilitates the formation of companies through the adoption of a short-form memorandum of incorporation and a notice of incorporation. What basically happens is that the bill, as currently stands, contemplates the creation of a short-form memorandum of incorporation, which will be made part and parcel of Schedule 1 to the Act when it is introduced. This short-form memorandum of incorporation will be a memorandum of incorporation, which will be a model memorandum of incorporation for companies that wish to adopt such memorandum of incorporation. It will actually constitute many of your default provisions and your provisions that will not be, that cannot be, companies, from which companies cannot be exempted in terms of the Companies Act. And as a result, all the provisions that cannot be modified or qualified in terms of the Companies Act will be in the memorandum of incorporation, and your default provisions will actually form basis of the memorandum of incorporation. And this will actually be your short-form memorandum of incorporation, which will be adopted by majority of companies, therefore doing away with the need for professional assistance when people register companies. Since they will be required to adopt the memorandum of incorporation, they could do this through a short-form memorandum of incorporation. And your notice of incorporation, which must at all costs be filed with the commissioner, whether the company is public interest or not, will be a very short-form notice of incorporation, which in most cases will be 1 page, consisting mainly of the most important information relating to, for example, the name of the company, the incorporator of the company, the directors of the company, the number of shares or securities with which the company is going to be registered, and the physical address of the company, the postal address of the company, and in case where the company has got a secretary, the name of the secretary and the details of the secretary of the company. Now, in addition to this memorandum of incorporation that could be adopted, the company may also design their own specific memorandum of incorporation, which will then take into account those provisions of the Companies Act that are not prohibited, and those that can be, those provisions that can be amended or allowed by the Companies Act to be amended. They could be amended to suit the specific needs of this particular company. And in addition to that, these are the types of companies that would be public interest companies, and in most cases they would need the assistance of a professional person like your accountant and your attorney to help them in drafting this kind of document. And in addition to that, we experience shows that these companies also need an extra document which will help them to facilitate governance, and which will be referred to as the internal rules concerning the governance of the company. These rules basically give certain powers to the board of the directors without the need to refer any all the matters to refer to in that governance document to a board of the directors or to the meeting of the board of directors or the shareholders of the company. And therefore facilitating governance, as experience has shown that many of such companies require such documents. And the charter also abolished the need for certification by the notary public and the requirement for a seal as the 1973 Act requires currently. Therefore, the notary public certification of the memorandum of incorporation by notary public is no longer a requirement in terms of the bill, and the requirement for a seal is also not provided for in the bill. Chapter 2 also provides for the abolition of the doctrine of constructive notice. This is the doctrine that any member of the public is deemed to have knowledge of the content of the documents of the company as long as they are publicly available. Now, that has caused a lot of anxiety and a lot of confusion even in the public in relation to enforcement of the members of the public's rights against certain companies where they will be deemed to have knowledge of the contents of the internal documents of the company. And what this bill attempts to do is to do away with the constructive notice, and also to do away with the adoption of ultra virus for the purpose of protecting the bona fide third party party members who contract with the company. The doctrine of ultra vires basically is a doctrine which says that if the company does not have the capacity to perform certain powers and any director of the company enters into a transaction which is beyond the capacity of the company, then that contract is actually void as if it was never entered into. That caused a lot of difficulties to that bona fide third party number two and then the transaction to companies. And what has happened is that even though the 1973 has been amended to try to ameliorate the situation was not effectively remedied. And the bill tried to do away with the need for the capacity of the company and give the company the capacity of an individual or a natural person so that it would have power that would generally be the powers of a natural person except those that cannot be exercised by a natural and a juristic person, and thereby doing away with the difficulties of the juristic, the ultra vires doctrine, and also by providing for the protection of those parties that enter into transactions with the company on a bona fide basis. Also, the chapter, what it attempts to do is to provide for expanded validation of the pre-incorporation agreement. Pre-incorporation agreements are very important for members because in a situation where a member of the public would like to form a company and he discovers a particular investment opportunity, but does not want to take up that opportunity in his personal capacity, but wants his company to take the particular opportunity. He may not have the capacity to represent the company if the company has not yet been formally registered, even though the member can prove that he has already submitted the documents to the commission and is only awaiting the certificate of incorporation. Because as common law, a person cannot be a representative or cannot act as a representative of a person not yet in existence. But what the bill attempts to do is it takes forward the concept which was introduced in the 1973 Act of enabling a member who professes to act on behalf of a company not yet formed to be able to make that company a party to the contract, so that when that company is ultimately incorporated, it can be able to adopt that contract and then become a party to the contract, as if the company was in existence at the time when the contract was entered into. And what happens is that under the 1973 Act, Section 35 actually didn't go far enough in the sense that it did not provide for eventuality in cases where the company is not ultimately incorporated or where the company is incorporated but does not adopt the contract as to who becomes personally liable in terms of that particular transaction. This bill goes forward to provide clarification in those areas, as does many of the jurisdictions that have underwent corporate law reform in recent years. Now, what is important and has caused a lot of confusion even in the media is the issue of name approval. Now, let me just explain one thing here before I can go into the process. Currently, the 1973 Act requires basically a self-standing initial process before one can enter into a registration process, and that is the name reservation process. What is required is that a member of the public must fill in a CM5 if he wants to establish a company, a name reservation form, or a CK7 if it is a closed corporation, a name reservation form. And that process is just that, the name reservation process. And it's quite different from the registration process, because you will only enter into the registration process once the name has been approved. That has actually caused a lot of delay in a number of cases where people would like to have companies in a matter of, in a quick manner. And it has actually caused a lot of anxiety to many outside investors who would like to incorporate in South African corporate sphere. Because sometimes it may actually take a long time for you to get your name approved. And what has happened in terms of the bill is that the bill proposes to do away with that self-standing name reservation process, but without doing away with the integrity of the name approval process, because the name approval process will still go on. But the name approval process will go on as part and parcel of the registration process, meaning that the proposed name will be on your notice of incorporation, and then the commissioner will, in line with the bill, then approve or disapprove of your name. And if he disapproves of your name, the process doesn't stop there. Then the commissioner is obliged to actually give you the unique registration number with which you can actually be able to trade, rather than be told to start the process all over again. And that unique registration number will also double up as a income tax number, so that you do not have to register twice, first with your commission and then secondly with South African Revenue Service. And what that means is that it will actually allow open opportunities for the commission to work hand in hand with the South African Revenue Service, where registration of incorporated businesses can actually be undertaken through the agency of the South African Revenue Service, since the name, the number that is applied for income tax purposes will be the same as the number that is applied for registration purposes in terms of the company's act. Therefore, that number can actually be used as a name. And if you would like to use that name, in that number indefinitely as a name, you can do that. But if you would like to change it, then you will be allowed to do a name reservation process so that you can replace that particular number at a later stage. And insofar as names are concerned, the commissioner is given very restricted discretion in relation to the acceptance or otherwise of the names of the company. And these are mainly in order to ensure that other people's rights are not contravened. For example, the right to name, where people pass off other people's names as theirs. And this relates to the names that are registered on the database of the commission. That will include the those corporations, your companies, your cooperatives. And it also extends to your intellectual property rights. So that any name that seeks to contravene any of those will not be accepted by the commissioner. And in addition to that, any name that seems to be in contravention of some of the fundamental rights of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa will not be acceptable as a name. And beyond that, there is no more discretion that is given to the commissioner to accept or reject the name. Under the current Companies Act and the Sales Corporations Act, in particular Section 19 of the Sales Corporations Act and Section 49 of the Companies Act, the registrar of companies and of the Sales Corporations is actually given wide discretion to an extent where he is actually given the right to reject a name if the name is undesirable in his opinion. And that is quite broad and has caused a lot of anxiety and problems with people who had the names rejected and who had worried as to whether this discretion was justified. And as a result, this will do away with such wide discretion, you know, that are given to the commissioner. And in the main, what would happen is that if a company is incorporated as a not-for-profit company, it will actually be followed by the expression not-for-profit company or the abbreviation NPC. In the case of a widely held company, it will be, the name of the company will be followed by the word limited or its abbreviation LTD, as it is currently the case for public companies. And in the case of your closely held companies, it will be followed by the expression CHC Limited or the abbreviation CHC LTD. In case of those closely held companies. Now, as I've already mentioned, that all companies are required to keep certain records for the purposes of complying with good governance standards. These records actually include the annual report, the accounting records, the memorandum of incorporation, shareholders meeting minutes, written communications to shareholders generally, register of directors, and directors meeting minutes and resolutions. All of those must be made acceptable to the shareholders of the company in line with Section 27. Now, this is just in brief the comparison between the current Companies Act and the proposed company law in terms of the sale. And I've already spoken to all of those points. I'm not going to repeat them. Chapter 3 basically deals with corporate finance. This is, in brief, the way in which your company is financed. And we know that to a large extent we had this rigorous differentiation of different instruments within the company, which in many cases have been overshadowed by practice, where you've got hybrid instruments that have been introduced in terms of the practice in so many companies. Derivatives have come into play, where you find securities that have got both the characteristics of your equity financing and your debt financing that are coming into play. We cannot provide for. Now the bill moves away from the strict categorization of your financing methods that is provided for under your Companies Act and goes to a process of flexibility we have to promote innovation and investment in the South African market and companies by providing for flexibility in the design and organization of companies. And what has happened is that the days where you have a share distinct from a debenture are over. You may have a share or a debenture that has got certain characteristics of a share in the sense that it may be allowed to participate in certain decision-making processes. Now what has happened is that the bill provides, for example, that where the memorandum of incorporation lacks or permits, it may actually be able to offer a debt instrument in the form of a debenture that may have certain rights which were originally reserved for your securities that are described under the current company side as your share. And it also allows for reclassification of those shares under certain circumstances by the board of directors where the memorandum of incorporation requires so. And in addition to that, it provides for equitable voting rights and interclass equality except as provided in the memorandum of incorporation. And it provides for class preferences and other rights. It also provides for preemptive rights. Now the preemptive rights are the right of a shareholder to be offered additional security in proportion to the securities that they are holding within the company when and as and when the company offers more securities within the company. And it also allows the company to be able to negate that particular right in a memorandum of incorporation if it wants to do so. But as a default provision, every company or every security holder will have that right, the preemptive right within the company. And in addition to that, it allows for shares to be paid for in exchange of any consideration determined by the board in line with proper standards of conduct as determined in Section 91. In particular, it allows the shares to be offered for a contract for future services or benefits or a promissory note, which have not been provided for under the current company set and have made it very difficult for transactions that that anticipate your financial assistance for or in connection with equity financing to be effective. And therefore, as a result, it has been an impediment to a large extent. Section 38 of the current company set has been an impediment to the effective implementation of, for example, the economic empowerment and other beneficial transactions on behalf of the company where financial assistance for equity financing is envisaged. The bill provides that shares are to have no par value, but it also says that all those shares that are currently having a par value will continue indefinitely to have par value in line with the transitional arrangements that are provided for under Schedule 6 of the bill. Now, in brief, a par value is an arbitrary figure given to, an arbitrary amount of value given to a share at the time when it is issued by the company. Now, in most cases, a company would issue shares at a very low par, which is what happened in the early 60s when many companies were established in South Africa under the 1926 legislation, which was then endorsed by the 1925 legislation, where shares were given a very low par value. And what is happening is that the par value bears no economic significance whatsoever, or bears no relationship to the economic value of the share, in the sense that over time it becomes extremely irrelevant and it just becomes a historical amount which has no relation whatsoever to the economic value. For an example, many of the companies that are currently trading on the stock exchange, some of them, you find that they trade, their shares traded around 550 rand, whereas the par value of those companies is actually standing at 50 cents. You know, this has actually created a lot of confusion, particularly to unsophisticated investors who would find their share certificate saying that they hold 7,000 shares in this particular company of 50 cents each. And many investors would think that that means that their shares are worth 50 cents times 7,000. Whereas that is not the case, because the economic value of the shares is actually beyond 500, and as a result, the economic value is well beyond that. And what has happened is that in many jurisdictions, the corporate legislation has actually gone ahead to do away with the title, where the company just issues a number of shares rather than a number of shares with a value. Then the value of those shares are determined by the market. Therefore, the value of the share is always in line with the economic value of the share, and therefore making it easy for people to be able to determine what value of shares or securities they hold in that particular company. The bill also goes forward to allow for financial assistance for the purpose of share purchases, and this is subject to your solvency liquidity test and your shareholder approval, and the shareholder approval must be in the form of a special resolution. And this is very different from what is currently the case under Section 38, where there is a blanket prohibition against financial assistance for equity financing. This actually prohibits financial assistance if it is prohibited by the Memorandum of Incorporation. But if it is not prohibited by the Memorandum of Incorporation, it basically allows it subject to the qualification of the solvency liquidity test and the shareholder approval. And furthermore, as I've already spoken about, the unnecessary distinctions based on artificial categorization of the debt instrument are done away with, where debt instruments may actually have certain vibes or characteristics of an equity instrument. And most importantly, Chapter 3 provides for rules that treat all distributions in the same way by subjecting them to the solvency and liquidity test. Now, the solvency and liquidity test is a test which says that the company has to be solvent in the balance sheet sense and also in the liquidity sense, in the sense that its assets must be equal to or exceed its liabilities, which is the solvency test, and it must be able to pay its debts as they fall due in the ordinary course of business, which is the liquidity test. And all distributions are actually subject to that. And your distributions are, for example, your share buybacks, your dividends, and your redemptions. Under the 1973 Act, the problem has been that distributions have been treated quite differently, even though the economic significance is the same. If you look at Section 85 of the 1973 Act, for example, deals with share buybacks. They subject the share buybacks to solvency and liquidity test. You look at Section 90, which deals with dividends, subject the dividends to the solvency and liquidity test. When you look at Section 98, which deals with redemption, which is another form of distribution, it's not subject to the solvency and liquidity test. And the question has always been, why treat all distributions with the good economy paying economic consequence differently? This bill moves away from that system of treating distributions differently and treat them in the same way by subjecting them to solvency and liquidity test. And the existing scheme of registration and transfer of transitory securities is modified in line with the Securities Services Act. Because currently the regime is provided for under Section 91, capital letter A of the Companies Act. What happens is that under Section 91A, capital letter A of the Companies Act, transfer of ownership in unsophisticated securities, these are securities that are not evidenced by way of a paper in evidence of paper security, paper certificate. Transfer in ownership of those securities has actually been effected at the central securities depository participant level. Let me just explain it this way. Where a company creates uncertificated securities, you do have a company which is referred to as an issuer on top. And then in the middle, you do have a central securities depository, which is your trade. Trade is the central securities depository in South Africa. Share transaction socialism is fine. And then trade has actually given licenses to a number of institutions, mainly banks, as participants, CSD participants. And now, when Section 91A was introduced in the legislation, I think it was in 1996, if I'm not mistaken, what has happened is that the right to transfer ownership in unsecured securities was actually could only be effected at CSD participant level, that is the bottom. But there was no opportunity for transfer of ownership at CSD level. What has happened is that internationally many countries are doing it both ways, that in line with the rules of the CSD, transferring ownership of the securities can be effected, which would mean that the CSD can be able to effect transferring ownership and also CSD participants. Now, in South Africa, it has always been the other way around, where CSD participants are held alive, but CSD does not have. And that is why then the bill has been reformed, or reforming that law, to allow for transfer of ownership in unsecured securities in line with the rules of the CSD, which would mean that even at CSD level, transferring ownership of securities may actually take place. And the rules relating to the primary and secondary offering of securities to the public is actually modified along the lines of the principles currently contained in the Act. And this where your company is doing an initial public offering, an ICO, that under such circumstances it will depend as to whether the company is required to issue a prospectus and what requirements the prospectus has to comply with, and if it is doing a secondary offering of the shares in the sense that the shares are not being offered to the public for the very first time, then it would need a statement to the public to give more information about the company itself so as to enable a reasonably aware investor to make an informed decision as to whether to invest in the company or not. And therefore the company is required to have a statement if it is a secondary offering of the shares and is required to have a prospectus in the case of an IPO, which is the primary offering of the shares to the public. Chapter 4 deals with corporate governance and financial accountability. I've dealt with some of the provisions that I dealt with under Chapter 4 when I dealt with the effect of being a public interest company. But for the sake of completion, Chapter 4, insofar as meetings are concerned, it actually allows for a default provision insofar as ordinary resolutions of companies are concerned, by allowing that a quorum threshold should be set at 25% of shares and capital support. And this is a move from the current situation and telepathy situation of allowing the quorum threshold to be one shareholder in respect of a private company, unless the particular company has got more than one shareholder, in which case two shareholders entitled to vote will constitute the quorum for the purpose of passing an ordinary resolution. Now, remembering that an ordinary resolution is a resolution that will bind the company, and therefore it is a decision of the company. And the current Companies Act actually says that in respect of a public company, at least three shareholders will be entitled to pass an ordinary resolution which will bind the company as a whole. The untenable result of that is that in a situation where a company has got millions of shareholders, decisions have been taken by a very insignificant number of shareholders within the company. And the law has actually given those decisions in the sense that any of the three shareholders of the company may be able to attend the meeting or may be able to present or to constitute a quorum for the purpose of passing and a resolution which would bind the whole company. And the default provision is now set at 25% of all the entitled to vote, so that there can be improvement of corporate governance standards, and also to encourage shareholder activism within South African companies, particularly those that are public interest companies. And the bill doesn't allow shareholders to participate in meetings by electronic communication, which is a new invention which has not been there under the General Assembly. And it also allows shareholders and directors to take binding decisions rather than at a meeting, meaning that in situations where there is consensus among those people who have got the authority to make a decision, that could be done without the need for legislation requiring a specific constituted meeting. And most importantly, and what has been in the news recently, is the bill sets out a general scheme of directors' duties, which includes both a fiduciary duty to act in the best interest and for the benefit of the company, and a duty of reasonable care which operates in tandem with existing common law duties. Now, what the bill basically does is to reflect the current common law in the form of the legislation without really, without affecting the standards of corporate governance, because it even increases the standards of corporate governance in the sense that, insofar as the standards of directors are concerned, at common law, the duty of care, skill, and diligence is a very subjective one, and the bill attempts to combine both the characteristics of a subjective and an objective test in determining whether this duty has been complied with, in the sense that it is not only the particular skill and experience of a director that are taken into account, but in addition to that are the skills and experience of a similarly situated director. What would a similarly situated director do under similar circumstances, as opposed to what would the director with the skill and experience of this particular director in question would have done, which will actually, in most all cases, bring different results. And as a result, it actually leads to a more improved corporate governance regime. And these duties are supplemented by provisions addressing conflicts of interest and directors' liabilities, indemnity and insurance, where indemnity and insurance is actually provided for directors in cases where there is no gross negligence. Now, insofar as Chapter 5 is concerned, to a large extent, the law as it currently exists under the takeover rules and under the Companies Act is preserved. But what has happened is that the fundamental transactions have now been redefined in line with international development, particularly the introduction of your merger and amalgamation provision, where instead of linking a merger and amalgamation to a scheme of arrangement in Section 311, you can have a self-standing merger whereby the business of the company can actually merge with the business of another company, and such company can then, or the remaining company can then become a merged entity for the purposes of the Companies Act, and will then have one memorandum of incorporation which will then affect the continuation of operations of the particular company. The result is that the debts and liabilities and the assets of all merging companies actually become the debts and liabilities and assets of the remaining entity. And that has not been possible under the Companies Act in the past. class, but I meant other than I'm going to be had. And the way in which fundamental transactions are approved is actually also modified, in the sense that under your scheme of arrangement and your disposal of the business of the company, you basically require a special resolution, and insofar as schemes of arrangement are concerned, you always require court approval. But now, the bill says that in relation to all those affected transactions, you only require a court approval if a substantial minority of the shareholders is opposed to the transaction, and that substantial minority is set at 15%. If 15% or more of the shareholders is opposed to the transaction, then you would require a court approval. But under any other circumstances, you do not require any court approval. And in addition to that, this particular regime of fundamental transaction is supplemented by the right to have your shares or your securities appraised and be bought out by the company at a fair value if you were opposed to the transaction, and the transaction nevertheless went ahead because the majority of the shareholders or the securities holders were in support of that transaction, and you already said your disapproval of the transaction, you can be able to require the company by law to appraise your shares, meaning that to value your shares fairly and to buy you out at a fair price. Now, most importantly, the bill introduces a new chapter dealing with the corporate registry, or what is referred to in the bill as a business registry. Now, this has the effect of replacing the current judicial management process, whereby the courts were approached by affected parties or interested parties to appoint a judicial manager in cases where the company is insolvent or on the brink of insolvency. And this judicial management system has always, almost in all cases, failed because of a number of reasons. In a number of cases, it is not supported by the creditors, in the sense that there is no regime that makes creditors to support this system. And secondly, that in all cases the management is substituted by the judicial manager who has got no yardstick in relation to the qualifications and is not regulated by any regulatory body for the purposes of performance of any of his duties. And now the bill proposes that this system needs to be replaced by a self-administered system whereby a company itself, not the liquidator, not the creditor, and not any other person, can actually be able to approach the court, but the company may be able to pass a resolution, an ordinary resolution, for the purposes of taking a company that is on the brink or on the way to financial difficulties into a business restriction, and as a result, there will be a moratorium on the essence against that company. Therefore, the company which is in possession of certain property can actually, what we call the debtor in possession, has certain rights that are protected during the particular period, at which time the supervisor will have to be appointed, and that supervisor will have the responsibility of monitoring management, and the supervisor will have to be independent and will have to veto or monitor certain transactions that are undertaken by the company under the guidance of the management for the purposes of turning the business around. Now, to a large extent, we received a number of comments here from participants who have said that even though management may remain, the most important thing is that the supervisors need to have an executive function. We do acknowledge that that is something that we will be considering, that the supervisor will have an executive function within this particular company during the time of turning this business around, and will work together with management, but will be given the power to replace management where management has been responsible for the financial position and of the company. And the bill recognizes the interest of all the role players within the company to participate in the development and approval of a business strategy plan, which will have to be suggested or prepared by this independent supervisor. And this interest stakeholders include the shareholders, creditors, and employees. And in particular, employees are given the right by recognizing them as creditors of the company with a voting interest to the extent of any unpaid remuneration. They are required, consultation with them is required in the development of a business strategy plan, and they are required to be given opportunity to address creditors before a vote on the plan, and they are accorded as a group the right to buy out any dissenting creditor who has voted against approving a business strategy plan. Now, we had a conference on Monday the 11th of June on that particular chapter in particular, because what has happened is that the department organized a workshop on the bill on the 18th and the 19th of March this year, and after it was published for public comment, and we realized towards the time when everything was set for the conference that there was an international insolvency conference that was going on here in Cape Town, to which many of the experts in the area of business rescue were invited and were participating. And therefore, at that conference, not so many people who had expertise and who were practicing in the area of business rescue were able to attend. But then the department decided that it was going to have a separate session with stakeholders on the business rescue in June, and it was well attended by the people within the Banking Association. Actually, all the banks of South Africa were there, were represented, and many of the liquidators and people who are involved in business administration and business turnaround in South Africa were there. And we were able to come up with recommendations which would then be included in the chapter 6 going forward. Now, Chapter 7 basically deals with remedies and enforcement. I said at the beginning that the aim of this bill has always been to move away from a more criminal system to a more administrative driven system insofar as enforcement is concerned. Therefore, insofar as any other civil remedies are concerned, the High Court remains the principal forum for those remedies. And insofar as the remaining criminal penalties are concerned, the High Court still remains the principal forum for the resolution of such remedies. But insofar as other remedies which have now been converted to being administrative penalties, the Commission, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, remains the primary forum for the resolution of such issues. But what is important is that in addition to training existing remedies, the bill introduces new remedies, which include the right to seek a declaratory order as to the shareholders' rights, the right to apply to have a director declared delinquent or under probation, and the appraisal right to exempt shareholders to certain actions, and the right to commence or pursue legal action in the name of the company, which will now replace the common law derivative action. And in addition to that, the bill establishes an extended right of standing to commence an action on behalf of an aggrieved person, and a regime to protect whistleblowers who disclose irregularities or contraventions of the act. And this will have to be administered in the main by the companies and the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. Now, in the main, this is the regulatory regime that is envisaged in terms of the bill, and this is provided for in Chapter 8. You have about four main institutions that are proposed. Basically, the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission is not entirely new in the sense that it is the reform of the Companies and Intellectual Property Registration Office, the current people. and the certain enforcement powers which are currently undertaken by the DCI through the Office of Companies and Intellectual Property Enforcement, what you call OCI, which will then be merged to form the particular commission. And its main responsibilities will be the registration, efficient and effective registration of all entities that are provided for in terms of this act and other laws, the enforcement of the law, and education of stakeholders in relation to the law, and also the compliance with the law generally, particularly through investigations and through inspections which will be undertaken within the commission, and the takeover regulation panel which will replace the current securities regulation panel for the purpose of assessing certain offers which are provided for under section, under chapter 5. Those are your fundamental offers, your profiles, the relates to public interest companies, and your takeovers and measures. And most important is the financial reporting standards. Financial Standards Reporting Council, which is now proposed under the Corporate Laws Amendment Act, will continue to be provided for under this bill. And its main function will be to advise the Minister on reporting standards, financial reporting standards, which will then be made public through the Government Gazette and by way of regulation, and which will then be applicable to all companies, and may be different depending on the type of company that is referred to in the case of a public interest company or the closely held company. And finally, a new institution that is proposed is the Companies Ombud. And the main responsibility of the Companies Ombud will be the accreditation of this resolution agency, which will be assist the Ombud in resolving disputes in a manner which is an alternative to court resolution of disputes, or judicial resolution of disputes, and also the Companies Ombud will also itself resolve the disputes between shareholders which are not of a judicial nature, and will also deal with appeals of administrative decisions that are undertaken by the commission, and in certain instances also by the takeover regulation panel. In chapter 9, what the bill proposes to do really is to a large extent decriminalize company law, in the sense that when you look at the current Companies Act, almost every provision is followed by an offense. And in a number of cases, it is not possible that all can be, all those offenses can actually be effectively implemented or effectively enforced. And if not so, that some of the offenses that are provided for are not really justified by any policy justification. And they are of such a minor nature in many cases that do not require the involvement of the judicial system. It is actually overstretching the judicial system for the purposes of enforcing certain minor offenses that could actually be replaced by civil or administrative penalties, and that is what the act tries to do. And therefore, there are very few remaining offenses, and those are those that arise out of a refusal to respond to a summons to give evidence, perjury, and similar matters relating to administration of the act. And any offenses such as those must be referred by the Commission to the National Director of Public Prosecution for trial in the Magistrates Court. And what the act does is that it generally uses a system of administrative enforcement in place of criminal assessments to ensure compliance with the act. Therefore, the commission and the takeover panel will actually be responsible for enforcement of their administrative decisions in most cases through the compliance notices, which if they are not complied with may become a contempt of court by a person who refuses to comply with such compliance or does not comply with such compliance notices. And as such, there will be a more effective compliance with the legislation rather than to provide for an offense for every single provision of, or contravention of the provision of the company's act. And as a result, we anticipate that the many of the contraventions of the Act will be easily dealt with by the Commission that will then have enforcement powers and compliance powers, as explained above. And most importantly, in order to improve corporate accountability, what the bill proposes to do is to make it an offense which is punishable by a fine or up to 10 years of imprisonment or both for a director to sign or agree to a false or misleading financial statement or prospectus, or to be reckless in the conduct of a company's business. That is one example when the director or directors are attached to a company trading under insolvent circumstances, which to their knowledge would not be able to satisfy the debts of all the creditors. Under such circumstances, it is aligned also with the Auditing Professions Act, which basically punishes the auditors with the same kind of punishment. And the issue has always been this needs to be aligned because the originator or the source of financial instruments that are the source of the punishment of the auditors is usually the chief directors of the company. Therefore, why do you then punish the person who signs off on the financial instrument without punishing the source of such financial instrument? Now, this is the proposed timetable for the reform going forward. I must add that this particular proposed reform timetable has just recently been proposed and has been submitted to the Director of approval. And it has not yet been approved, but it's most likely that it will be approved. Yeah, given the fact that we received over 100 comments, which I'm very loath to just say their comments, their essays on the company's bill, which amounted to more than 2,000 pages. It has been quite a task to update the company's bill following those comments. And given the fact that we were also affected in the recent past by a number of the ongoing strike within the public sector, that we were not able to finish the updating of the bill in time, we are anticipating that the bill could be updated following those comments by the 31st of August this year, and we anticipate that the bill could be submitted to Cabinet round about the 31st of October this year, and that the bill should be submitted to state law advisors around about the 1st of November this year, and that it should be introduced in Parliament round about April 2008 for passing into law during that particular year, towards the end of that year of 2008, and for the bill to become effective in 2009, towards the end of 2009, the beginning of 2010. These are my details. If members would like to communicate with me via email or via telephone, those are my details. And let me take this opportunity to thank you. I see that I have taken more time than what I thought I would, and I always make sure at the beginning that this is not the kind of presentation that you can really set, you know, a very limited time when you come into it, because it is an overwhelming reform of company law that has never been done in over 30 years, and therefore it involves all aspects of company law. When I was doing the same presentation with the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, we actually took 2 full days. And therefore, you can imagine, we still didn't finish up to my satisfaction in the sense of covering all aspects of company law that are currently under review. But thank you very much for listening to me for over an hour. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You know, members, I want to propose something to the leadership. Look at my proposal, I need 4 weeks. We have acted approach with a presentation. I want us to look at time in August when we come back. Well, we will have enough time for this. We have studied everything so that we have a better understanding. I don't think we'll do justice to today. I think you foresaw it. An hour or two is nothing. But we can set aside time. A day at least. Because we want to involve provinces as well. So that we have a better understanding of the economic committees in our whatever the way they call it, committees in the provinces, whether they are clustered or whatever. If they are clustered, they are clustered. So that we deliver it with them. Because at the end of the day, they would have to be involved. So maybe as this is, I understand this is still new, but maybe you could begin to do our work now, before 2008 and the passing of the bill, or enacting it to law, will assist us. I don't think it could be the right thing for us. But I'm not deciding for you. So I'll look at him. Mr. Mkono, Mrs. Temba, or Mr. Clear the last.
I want to start with you because I think this is a very important day. Also people to support the economy. And there are also other issues here which one might want to understand in terms of your electronic communication for the direction and stuff like that. And to see whether in terms of our economy, how does that affect us? So, without getting into the details, I was going to say I support your idea, and then perhaps even if it can be out of Parliament, we don't have a problem with that, so that there are no interference and stuff like that.
Mr. Sandler,
can we
have
I also want to say. This is was really a comprehensive presentation, and I really thank people for even alerting us before to say just can't take 45 to an hour. It really needs a lot of time and really appreciative. So if maybe when we come back, even before we come back, if maybe Chabam can look at time. Look at the program of Parliament and program of Labour, public enterprises, and take those 2 days, even if it's 1.5 days. Because maybe we can even do it in the form of a workshop so that we understand clearly, so that when we even go to as the chairperson was saying, the provinces, because we represent provinces, when the province says, maybe the next public hearings, we know that we are really going to be fully engaged on the issues of this. It's a very, very important. Our surprise to you, it's a very big document that are we really going to, in 1 hour or 1.5 hour, are we really going to make this? We get to the first thing. I agree with you. And on another corner there. Let's say today is an information meeting. If there are questions for clarity on chapter, so that when we go away, we can look at it. But I'm seconding what you said. Can you please?
Madam Chairperson, I'm very sure that I can be in some of the things that have been talked about before, I think have been useful in terms of them being part and parcel of the background who want to understand the presentation by. You see, with me as an individual, I have got very little financial background. Now, you see, when you talk in monetary terms, first of all, it tends to frighten me, not because it's wrong, but because there is that element in me that, hey, I need something in the background. You know, when you talk about words like dementia, they remind me of things I went through before I came here. I was in the legislature and I was writing the rules of the speaker. We used to have a number of one thing, and also by another thing, went through all those ways. You know, the moment you talk about money, those things come to my mind. Like if I were to go to the constituency area of my own and people raise these issues, I can bet there will be very little chance for me to be able to explain them the way they are supposed to be in terms of the information of government. I was going to make an emphasis on what Mr. Mkono said while he was supporting the suggestion from the chairperson. If possible, let's go out of these things. Where we will be able to fully consider all these things, and perhaps we will be drilling some of us to get into the mainstream of the financial language, let alone the specifics of this bill. So that I'd be able to think in terms of the flow of the presentation, not in terms of the message carried in the information plane. I think it will be useful for me. So, in short, I very strongly support the suggestion, and I also emphasize the issue of us being somewhere where we don't be disturbed every now and then by some of our colleagues who work with the
Thank you very much, Member. I take it that will be some time in August, and we will then apply it to a few of the cities from when we will start in September time as well, the South Committee time, but one of the cities, so that we can really, because we need to study this first. Well, I don't think I'm able to ask any questions. I went through the hard copy. But again, without the background I need, my questions will not be. If that's the conclusion, would love to thank the circle and the acting DG, but we could give you the opportunity.
Okay. I think I would echo the same concerns myself. What I would also suggest is that in my presentation to the Portfolio Commission Trade and Industry, they also requested background information and certain extra information on some areas that they wanted, technical areas that they wanted explanation prior to them engaging in the bill, and we have also forwarded such documents to them. We can be able to forward those documents to this committee via the secretary, and also forward to you some of the materials that we sort of developed in the process towards where we are at the moment on this track. So that when we have the workshop, at least we will be having clear and broader information on where we are going. Thank you.
Well, on that note, Chapo, we really want to thank you for your time and the expecting to be here, and for the information we've got now, but we'll then await for the other information that you will send us. You can go to Chabanga or Secretary, or even talk to the parliamentary liaison officer.
Oh, yes.
We'll definitely get that information.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really have to tell you a lot of time.
Yeah. I believe
But don't say that.
No, it was. I don't know.
Gracias. Sí. 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 Sí.